We are going to get started. This is the last session of this class. What we are going to do today is we're going to learn a little bit of new material, and we're also going to have a little bit of time to kind of put together, maybe see the landscape of what is truly so odd about this set of laws. And we'll also explore a little bit more about like what might be animating certain decisions behind these laws. Okay, so we are going to get started. We are starting with the sixth Mishnah. Ein ha'idim zomemin neharagin ad sheyigamer hadin. The perjuring witnesses, right, the edim zomemim, are only put to death after the end of the trial. Okay, now this is a very specific time. We're going to see it's going to become even more specific when we get to the Gemara. But the law here is even if it's a very long trial, right? And these witnesses were sort of caught early, then actually they aren't put to death. You know, put to death in a case where what they're testifying about is death, right? You're not just always put to death. Okay, that essentially there needs to be enough of a trial, you have to have done enough to be considered liable, but not necessarily having gone all the way. Okay, Shaharei HaTzedukin Omrim Ad SheYeHareg, that according to the Sadducees, you only get put to death for actual murder, okay, until the accused is actually executed. As it says, nefesh tachat nefesh, that we're giving a life for a life. Okay, so here you have a very clean and very core machloket, right? A dispute between the way the rabbinic world is reading this set of psukim and the way that the Sadducees are reading this set of psukim. And for better or for worse, the Sadducees have a lot of logic behind them, right? We learned numerous times, okay, that these perjuring witnesses, these Edim Zomimim, are being put to death for what is essentially attempted murder, right? And generally, legal systems do not treat attempted murder as seriously as they treat actual murder. So the Sadducees look at the continuation of the psukim where it says nefesh tachat nefesh, that when you do to the perjurers the way that they had attempted to do, okay, the way that the Sadducees read it is no, you actually do to them what they have done, okay, and so they're only going to be killed if they success fully testified, okay, and that testimony led to somebody losing their life. Then the Sadducees see, oh, say, okay, you are functionally a murderer. Its truth is that you murdered through speech and you didn't murder with a gun, okay, but the person who you testified against is now killed, so you have to be killed. Okay, that's the Sadducees' perspective. It makes a lot of sense because, in the Sadducees' mind, we're not going to put someone to death for attempted murder. Okay, but the rabbis say explicitly, you are actually being put to death for even attempted murder. Okay, and the point at which the rabbis would say you are liable is when the trial has ended. Okay, but the sages said to them, Amrula hamachachamim, v'halo kvar ne'amar, v'asitem lo ka'asher zamam la'asot la'achiv. But you are supposed to do to him as he schemed, as he planned to do to his brother. Okay, so if the pasuk says that we're punishing you for what you planned, that means even attempted murder. Okay, so what are we going to do, right? The pasuk says kasher zamam. That means as he planned, not as he successfully executed. Okay, basizem lo kasher zamam lasot lachiv. You're doing what he wanted to do to his brother, v'harei achiv kayam. Okay, and his brother is still alive. Ve'im kein. But if that's the case, okay, if we're going to be punishing these witnesses for the attempt, Then lama ne'amar nefesh l'chanafesh. But what about the proof text of the Sadducees that say it has to be a life for a life, not a life for an attempt? So then we're going to explain. Yachol misha'a shekiblu edotan yeregu. Maybe the perjuring witnesses are going to be liable from the moment they gave their testimony. Talmud Lomar comes to teach us nefesh tachat nefesh. It has to be really a life for a life. Ha einan neharagin aja yigamer hadin. We learn from this that the perjuring witnesses are only killed after the termination of the trial. Okay, just want to explain this one more time because the Sadducees have a lot of wisdom behind them and the rabbis, not unusually, are trying to thread a very small needle. Okay, essentially the Sadducees say, it says a life for a life, okay? That's not just a, like, reading of a pasuk, that is also a claim that you can't kill someone if they haven't actually killed, right? That's not justice. We don't kill people for attempted murder. That's what the Sadducees say, okay? But then the rabbis say, but this is a case where we're punishing people for scheming, okay? We're not punishing people for killing with words. We're punishing people for scheming. And so therefore, these psukim have to be able to cover someone who has attempted murder and hasn't yet been successful. But at what point do we say their violation is significant enough, real enough, okay, that we would say they're liable for death? It has to be after their testimony has actually been accepted and has led to a guilty verdict. Because once that has led to a guilty verdict, it is as good as if they killed this person. And therefore, that's the point at which they get killed, right? So if you are there, and you're watching the testimony, and you know that these people are eating zomimim. If you jump in and accuse them the second they open their mouths, you're going to ruin your opportunity. What you have to do is wait for this precise moment where the decision of the court has gone according to the eidim zomimim. They've essentially placed a death penalty on the head of the accused. At that point, the Eidim Zomimim are considered to not just be talkers, right, who might even be spared any punishment, but actually people that have caused death, even though the death itself has not actually taken place. So if you want to maximally punish the perjuring witnesses and save the guy who they are testifying against, you need to get in at this exact moment where the testimony has been accepted. The judgment has been made, but the death penalty hasn't yet been executed. Okay, that is the moment. Okay, when we go into the Gemara and after the Gemara I'll take questions, you'll see that the rabbis push it even further. In the world of the Mishnah, essentially, the rabbis just push it a little bit earlier. The Sadducees say he needs to be literally dead. Nefesh, tachat nefesh. And the rabbis say, he doesn't have to be literally dead. He could be as good as dead, right? Once the court has decided that you're liable for death, you're liable for death, okay? And it's a special mitzvah to not dilly-dally, right? In America, people can sit on death row for decades. In rabbinic understanding, that is considered to be cruel. And as soon as you know that the person is liable for the death penalty, you start putting that in motion, okay? So when they decide that they're going to kill you, there's not that much time before you're actually dead. So in the Mishnah, the rabbis say he doesn't have to be actually dead. He could be legally dead, I think maybe is the best way to think about it. And that would be enough for the Eidim Zomimim to be liable. I'm going to say this one more time so that you understand where things change. Sadducees, he has to be dead. Pharisees, the sages, the rabbis say he has to be as good as dead. He does not have to be actually dead in order to cause the Edim Zomamim to be fully punished. That's the Mishnah. And now the Gemara is going to say something wild that's going to blow your minds. Tana, it is taught, Beribi says, okay, Beribi is not a person's name. Beribi is an honorific. Okay, he says, Lo harago neharagin. Harago ain neharagin. Beribi says, if they did not kill, they are killed. If they did kill, they are not killed. Okay, now we're pushing the Sadducees out even further. Instead of saying that the accused doesn't have to have been already killed, now we're saying if he was already killed, then the Edim Zomamim are off the hook. Okay, this is a crazy thing that he says, and we don't see it challenged in the Gemara. Okay, so it's crazy, and it seems to be sustained, to use courtroom terminology, that it's not only that we don't have to wait until the person has been killed, they can be as good as killed. Beribi says, no, it's actually this precise moment. If they actually succeeded in killing the accused, that is no longer considered ka'asher zamam la'asot, what they planned to do, but rather ka'asher asu, what they did. And so Beribi says, we have to thread the needle even more finely. Not only, okay, do we consider them to only really have fully violated the law against Edim Zomamim when the decision has been made to kill the accused. But if the court was super snappy and they already went and killed him, then the Edim Zomamim do not absorb that punishment. They themselves are not killed. Right? Then we can go and ask, are they going to get lashes? Is something else going to happen to them? That's a very good question. But this very narrow definition corresponds to a very narrow slice of time after the judgment has been made, but before the judgment has been executed. Okay, we're going to continue on. Tanya, Rabbi Yehuda ben Tabai says, I will see the consolation. Ereh b'nechama, this is kind of like a way of swearing on the temple that is soon to be rebuilt. Okay, will I see the consolation if I did not kill a conspiring witness in order to remove from the hearts of the Sadducees who were saying conspiring witnesses are not put to death until the accused is killed? Okay, so Rabbi Yehuda ben Tabai says, we're not just talk here. Okay, just an important thing to say in this kind of context. He says, I swear by the rebuilt temple, okay, that I definitely killed a conspiring witness, right? A witness who conspired but didn't succeed in killing the accused. And then Shimon ben Shetach said to him, well, I can also swear, Ereh b'nechama, will I see the consolation if you did not spill innocent blood? For the sages said, conspiring witnesses are not put to death until both of them are proven conspirators, and they are not lashed until both of them are proven conspirators. Okay, so essentially Rabbi Yehuda ben Tabai says, I killed a conspiring witness. And Shimon ben Shetach said, you can't just kill one. You have to kill the set. Okay, immediately Rabbi Yehuda ben Tabai accepted upon himself that he would not issue a legal ruling except in the presence of Shimon ben Shetach. Okay, and part of what's going on here is Rabbi Yehuda ben Tabai, when he's willing to kill a single witness, is essentially saying the corrupt testimony is the problem, not the success of the testimony. So even if this person actually never would have been able to bring this person to death, because they're only one witness, they're not two, I'm still going to put him to death because I need to show the Sadducees what's what and that we're really serious about killing, you know, conspiring witnesses. And then Shimon ben Shetach said, you killed an innocent person. This person was not able to effectively kill who they were accusing. And you can't just kill them in order to turn the knife in the Sadducees. Okay, it has to be a testimony that is actionable testimony. Okay, otherwise you cannot punish them. And then Rabbi Yehuda ben Tabbai understands this and he realizes. And all the days of Yehuda ben Tabbai, he would prostrate himself on the grave of that witness. And his voice was heard. And people thought to say it was the voice of the one who had been killed. Okay, people would see him. He was in the cemetery. And he was always lying on the grave of this person that he killed because he thought he was killing righteously. Right, he's going to show the Sadducees that we mean business. He's going to show this guy that we mean business. And then he learned from Rabbi Shimon ben Shetach, okay, that he was wrong. And that we don't kill them unless they could have really actually been effective, okay, in causing that harm. And so people thought when they saw him on the grave and they heard voices, they thought it was the voice of the guy who he killed, okay, the Eid Zomim that he killed. And then he said, no, 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 Koli Shali, it's my voice. Teidu l'machar hu meit, you should know tomorrow he will die and his voice will not be heard. Okay. And Rav Acha said, son of Rav Ashi said to Rav Ashi, it's a lot of Ravs, perhaps he stood with him in judgment, or perhaps he appeased him. Okay, so essentially, right, Rabbi Yehuda ben Tabbai prophesies his own death. Okay, when he says, tomorrow he will die, he means me. Okay, and he's like, I'm here, and I'm, you know, on the grave of this guy, and I'm crying, and I'm talking, okay, and you think that it's the voice of his ghost, but actually it's my voice, and I am prophesying about myself, that I will die, and you'll know that it was me, because you're not going to hear any talking anymore, okay? So what is going on here, right? Rabbi Yehuda ben Tabbai is essentially saying, because I killed this conspiring witness, even though he was truly a conspiring witness, I believe that I have spilt innocent blood, and I am going to be crying on his grave until I die, and I'm telling you I'm going to die soon. Okay, and there's something very interesting here about him testifying about his own death. Okay, so let's just review what we've seen, and then I will pause for questions. The Mishnah says, The Sadducees have a hard line. You have to wait until the accused dies. Okay, the intended victim of the Eidim Zomamim, he needs to die in order for them to be killed for killing him. Because we say a life for a life. Then the Pharisees come, the sages come, and they say, no, 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 no. This is about Kasher Zama. This is what he planned to do, not what he actually did. So you could kill them earlier. Once Nigmar Hadin, once the decision has been made, okay? And then the rabbis and the Gemara push it even further, and they say, and not even that, but if he's already been killed, okay? If the accused, right, the victim of the Eidim Zomamim has already been killed, then the Eidim Zomamim are off the hook, because this is really about what they planned to do, okay? They have to have been somewhat effective, okay? So it has to be after Nigmar Hadin, after the conclusion of the court case. But if they actually succeeded in killing the guy, they're not attempters. They're succeeders. And they don't get killed for being succeeders, which is a crazy irony. Okay, and then we have Rabbi Yehuda ben Tabbai, and he's like, I want to show the Sadducees even more. Okay, first we showed the Sadducees by saying he doesn't need to be killed. Then we showed the Sadducees by saying, in fact, if he is killed, the Eidim Zomamim are off the hook. And now Rabbi Yehuda ben Tabbai wants to show the Sadducees and say, and even if it's only one witness, I'm going to kill him. I'm going to show you that they don't need to be successful in order to be blameworthy. And then Shimon ben Shetach kind of repeats the rabbinic line and he says, no. They had to have at least had the potential. They had to have really done something, okay? Even if what they did wasn't fully completed yet, they had to really have done something, okay? And a single witness has no legal weight, and therefore you can't really kill him for being a conspiring witness, Okay, and then we see that Rabbi Huzza ben Tabai really learns this lesson, and he's prostrating himself in the grave, and he's crying, and he thinks that he has so sinned that he is going to meet his death as well. Okay, I'm going to pause here for questions on this Mishnah and the Gemara that follows. I kind of waited till the end to show you the thing that I think is like the most crazy. Right, the most crazy thing that you could say about the Edim Zomamim is, if they are completely successful, they are off the hook. And that's essentially what Baribi says, and nobody bothers to challenge that.
Good morning. I have to admit, I am not following. I'm following the Sadducees' reasoning, but I'm not following the second argument of why I'm not following Baribi's reasoning at all.
Are you following the rabbis in the Mishnah?
I think so.
Okay. So the rabbis in the Mishnah are pointing out that the Pasuk says, Kasher Zama, as he planned. You have to do to him as he planned. Okay, and so they're emphasizing the word zamam, the plan, and not the success. Okay, and then Baribi pushes that even further, and he says, right, this is a punishment for witnesses who planned. It's not a punishment for witnesses who have succeeded. And therefore, if the witnesses did succeed, they're no longer Edim Zomamim. We could call them something else. We can call them Edim Horgim. Right, they're lethal witnesses, and therefore what they did is terrible. Okay, maybe they're murderers, but they no longer fit under the category of conspirers because they're no longer planners; they're didders. Okay, that's the fine thing that Baribi is saying. What he's saying makes a lot of sense if you are not thinking about things in terms of morals, right?
Right.
If you're just thinking in terms of what most closely fits the definition of attempted, well, if you're successful, then you're less attempted, right, than someone who attempts and is not successful.
So he's not saying, I guess what confuses me is how you get from there. Like, it feels like, I get that he's kind of splitting hairs and being careful about how we define them. Like, okay, fine, they're a different category. But how do we get from there to, and therefore they don't get any punishment, either death or lashes, and no one challenges it?
Yeah, so we don't know. They might get a different punishment for testifying falsely. That's a dispute. So let's not say anything about no punishment.
Okay.
I think that maybe the piece that we're missing and is the reason why the Gemara continues to tell the story about Yehuda ben Tabai is that Baribi is motivated by sticking it to the Sadducees, okay? He is willing to let an Eid Zomim who is guilty off the hook in order to show the Sadducees, we read it differently than you do. You are focusing on the success. We are so focused on the attempt that we even view the success as a mitigating factor. Okay, it's a crazy thing to say. I will use this language. It is crazy. It is a crazy thing to say if all you are motivated by is justice. But people are never motivated by just one thing. Okay, and the rabbis are highly motivated around disproving the Sadducees. Okay, and they might be willing to say some things that seem to us a little bonkers town to advance that goal, right? And Rabbi Huda ben Tabai, he spilled innocent blood to advance that goal and then needed Rabbi Shimon ben Shattach to kind of like pull him off the ledge and be like, yes, the Sadducees are bad. Yes, we're in a war with them, but no, you can't just kill innocent people because you're trying to make a point. Okay, good. Yes, Daphna.
Why don't ethics make a show in here?
What a good question. I think that for now, when we're just looking at it on the surface, I think it's fair to say that ethics isn't the only thing that is in play, we are going to get to like what actually is going on here in a minute. Okay. Very fair question. Very important question. I think a question that all of us have, which is like, well, it's all well and good to have very accurate or creative readings of the Torah, but like, we're not going to like let people off the hook or kill them just willy-nilly. That seems crazy. Yes. And wrong. I'm saying crazy, but you're trying to upgrade appropriately to say exactly. That's just wrong.
Yes.
Okay, good. Fair. I will take that critique and also just a reminder that I am the messenger and please do not shoot me. Okay. So I wanted to have like a nice list for you of all of the things that we have seen, okay, that really make Edim Zomamim seem like a very bizarre or maybe bizarre and unethical set of laws, okay? So the first thing, where we talked about it for a while, is that Edim Zomamim are being put to death for attempted murder. Once you disagree with the Sadducees and say that they don't need to have been successful in order to be held to account, then you're essentially saying we're putting someone to death for attempted murder, which is a very unusual thing to say. I'm not sure that's an unethical thing to say, but it is generally not the case, okay, in most advanced legal systems. Two, this is what we just learned from Beribi, the Edim Zomamim are not put to death if their intended victim actually was put to death. They are punished only for attempting and not for succeeding. That's the weirdest one. Going back a little bit to some of the things that we already learned in the previous weeks, three, we always believe the second set of witnesses. I will just put in here witnesses B, which is what we've been calling them. Okay, the Mizimin, even if we have significant reason not to believe them, right? That was the case where they said one thing and then witnesses C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P all corroborated the first witnesses. Even in that scenario, we don't say, maybe something's wrong with witnesses B. We just always believe them, okay? And also in general, right? If there's two witnesses A and two witnesses B, why are we believing witnesses B just because they came second, okay? So there is this very core presumption that witnesses B are telling the truth, okay, even when we have reason to believe that they're not telling the truth, or even if we just have no reason to privilege them, okay? We always privilege them no matter what. And the fourth thing that is weird is actually the first thing that we learned in the class, which is the Edim Zomamim can only be considered contradicted on the basis of their ability to testify, not the content of their testimony. I'm not sure if this was the clearest way for me to put it, so I will explain it again, right? We learned that witnesses B, right, the content of witnesses B's statements needed to be imanu hayitem. You were with us. You couldn't possibly have seen that murder in Boston because you were with us in New York. Okay, but if the testimony of witnesses B was that murder couldn't have happened in Boston because the victim was with us in New York, that is not considered to be contradicted testimony. Okay, so we have these four oddities. I think two is the most odd, and then it's 1, 3, 4 in terms of less odd. Okay, but you know, when you put it together, it really creates a picture of like what is going on here. And I want to subtly suggest, okay, that just as we saw with the Sadducees, like a lot of what is going on here is not designed to be the best way to handle these Edim Zomamim in terms of what they have done, okay? If you're just looking at what they've done, attempted murder is not as bad as real murder. Okay, but if you have other concerns, like maintaining the integrity of the legal system, like showing the Sadducees who is boss, right, then you might treat the Edim Zomamim differently than you would if you were only concerned with this particular witness talking about this particular case. Okay, and often the way that the Torah will communicate to you, hey, this is about a point, This is about something larger. This isn't just about this person and what they have done. Okay, is that the Torah will say, Uvi'arta hara mikirbecha. You should destroy the evil that's in your midst. So I don't know if you have ever seen the Mi Yodea Substack. Basically, one of the earliest like internet sites for people who have Torah questions. And there's often like a lot of very interesting stuff on there. So like when I have a Torah question and I Google it, if there's a Mi Yodea Substack, I always go there. Okay, and so here, this very lovely poster, I don't know his name, okay, commented that there's seven places where it says, Uviyarta harab mikir becha, okay? Executing, it's all in Hebrew here because I'm just copied and pasted him. Executing a Navi Sheker, okay? This is a case where we're going to kill a false prophet. Executing idolaters. Punishing Edim Zomamim. Executing a Ben Sorer Umoreh. The Ben Sorer Umoreh is this rebellious son who's like out too much, eating a little bit too much, drinking a little bit too much, and he gets killed, okay? Executing a woman who cheated on her husband between Kiddushin and Nisuin. Essentially, she's an engaged woman. She's not a married woman, okay? Executing a Narasa Murasa who was in the city. This is a subset of the previous one where essentially we are killing someone for being unfaithful, okay? Executing a kidnapper who sells a Jew as a slave, okay? In all of these cases, the Torah says, Uviyarta hara mikir becha. Okay, there's a world, and I think we're actually living in this world, where, like, people can say whatever they want, and nobody does anything about it, okay? And you're could say it's just words. But nevertheless, when it comes to the Navi Sheker, we say there's something about this person who is corrosive. Ubi'arta hara mikir becha, you need to burn them out. And we don't say, oh, they're just talking. We kill them with no mercy. Okay? And then there's two other cases. Executing a Zakein Mamre, that's a like rebellious rabbi. Because he has higher status, or because there are people who are likely to listen to him, then he gets executed for a rebellion that a regular person wouldn't be killed for. Okay, and then two more examples. We don't need to go through all the examples. Okay, but essentially, what the Mi Yodea guy is pointing us to is like, there are a few places in the Torah where, I'm using my language, not his, it looks like the Torah is overreacting. Okay, I think Ben Sorer Umoreh is like our classic example of this, but like this person's prefrontal cortex is still a baby, okay? And you're killing them for disobeying their parents. Teens disobey their parents, right? There's this sense of like, you're overreacting. And then the Torah coming back and saying, I'm not overreacting because you're only thinking about this particular case and I'm thinking about the system. And within the system, this is corrosive. Okay, and then the question becomes, and this is the question maybe that Daphna is asking, should a person die a real death for a symbolic problem, right? Essentially, you are trying to shore up the legal system, and therefore you're killing actual people? Like, these people didn't ask to be examples, right? They just did their own individual sins, and yet they're being martyred, okay? In order to kind of teach society a lesson, there's something about that doesn't sit right. Okay, and therefore, we have this idea, which some of you may have encountered in other areas, where we say, you know what, in some of these cases, we don't actually think they ever happened. Okay, the only, maybe, response to these laws seem very symbolic. And therefore, it seems unfair to kill somebody for symbolism. The response to that might be, yeah, you know what? They are symbolic. And they're on the books for the symbolism. And nobody ever actually dies because of these laws. Okay, we don't say them about all the laws, but we do say that about some. Okay, so I'm bringing you a Gemara in Sanhedrin from the 8th chapter that talks about this Ben Sorer Umoreh, this rebellious son, okay, who is the paradigmatic example of someone who we're like, isn't this just like a boogie story for parents to tell their children. Like, you know, and many, like one of the greatest tools that a parent has in their toolbox is the idle threat. Isn't this just like an idle threat? Like, I'm going to take you down to court. And when they hear what mama and I have to say, they're going to put you to death. And then the kid is like scared straight, right? So there's some way of understanding the ben sora umore as being just a very textual, scared straight program. Okay. But, right, we have to learn it and we have to treat it as a real law. And this is something that some people might find more comfort in and some people might find less comfort in, but I'm just going to tell it to you straight because it's a fact. Often when the rabbis disagree with a Mishnah or they disagree with some kind of law, they don't feel like they have the authority to come out straight and say, this law is bad. I need to get it off the books. So what do? They use the tools that they have at their disposal, which are the tools of interpretation, and they can interpret something in such a way as to minimize it out of existence, okay? So we're gonna have a case of that possibly with the ben sora umora. Tanya nami hachi, we have another braita, where Rabbi Yehuda says, if his mother was not identical to his father, identical in appearance, height, and voice, kol mara ukoma, he does not become a ben sorer umore. Okay? In order for your child to be put to death for being rebellious, you need to be indistinguishable from your husband. Okay? Same face, same height, same voice. We all know couples that look eerily alike. Okay? But I have never met a couple that is this similar. Maybe their faces are almost the same, but that they're also the same height and they also have the same voice? Not likely. Okay, but Rabbi Yehuda says they need to have the same because it says, the verse says that when the parents go to the court to complain about their bad kid, einena shomea bikolenu. He doesn't listen to our voice, not our voices. He doesn't listen to our voice. So that means that the father and the mother need to have an indistinguishable single voice. Just as the voice needs to be identical, so too the appearance and the height need to be identical. Okay, so essentially Rabbi Yehuda comes in and he says, sure, we could have a ben sorer umore on the books. But just for your clarification, the parents need to be extremely specific. They need to be so specific, okay, that the Gemara is going to go on and say explicitly, maybe what Rabbi Yehuda is trying to do here is legislate this law out of existence. According to whom was it taught in a Braita, ben sorer umore lo haya velo atid lihiyot. This stubborn and rebellious son never existed and will never exist. Velama nichtav, so why was it written? Derosh v'kabel schar, so you may expound upon it and receive reward. In accordance to whom? In accordance with Rabbi Yehuda. Okay, so the Gemara comes in and they say, oh yeah, we know what Rabbi Yehuda is doing here. He is the champion for the people who are like, ben sorer umore, too crazy. Never did happen, never will happen. Parents are not going to kill their kids because they drank too much. Not going to happen. Okay? So who is the person that enables them to say this? Rabbi Yehuda. Because Rabbi Yehuda narrows the applicable area of these laws to a place where it could never happen. It's never going to happen. People don't, no two people look alike, okay? So that's the Gemara saying that explicitly. Or you could say it's Rabbi Shimon, okay, who says it explicitly. It's Rabbi Shimon. As it was taught in a Braita, that Rabbi Shimon said, is it because this one ate a tartemar of meat, that's just a unit of measurement, and drank half a log, another unit of measurement, of Italian wine, that his father and mother bring him out to be stoned? Rather, he never existed and never will exist. And why was it written? So that you may expound it and receive reward. Okay, so the first opinion of the Gemara is, Rabbi Yehuda is kind of like very subtly legislating this out of existence. When he says the parents need to be 100% identical, that's his way of basically ensuring that this will never happen. And Rabbi Shimon basically comes in and he's like, it's never going to happen because it's bonkers. Okay? Parents are not going to kill their kid for eating a little too much meat. It's not a thing. Okay? V'lama nichtav, right? So why is it even written if it's never going to happen? Derosh v'kabel sechar. There's something to be learned about the story. There's something to be learned about the law. And the law doesn't ever need to be executed. These psukim never need to be live in order for them to teach you the lessons. Okay? But then Rabbi Yonatan comes in and he's like, what the hell are you talking about? It's in the Torah. I saw him and I sat on his grave. Okay? Rabbi Yonatan is like, no, I will not allow you to, you know, claim that there are satanic verses in the Torah. Everything that is there because we are supposed to listen to it. And if it seems unreasonable to you, that's your problem. That's what the Torah says. Okay? Rabbi Yonatan's like, oh no. Oh, he definitely has existed. This is a real category. Definitely has existed. Okay? And then the Gemara goes on and it does this same strategy for two other categories of Jewish law. Okay? One where you like totally destroy a city because there's some idol worship in it, and one where you totally destroy a house because it has some tzaraat, right? Some leprosy type disease in the walls. And essentially, the Gemara goes forward and it brings more examples of where the specifications for this thing to happen is so narrow that we just kind of believe that it's never going to exist. It's never going to happen. Okay. I want to read the last Mishnah of our Perek together so that we can kind of have a sense of like what the rabbis are droshing and kabeling schar about, to use not English, right? We said, if this thing is never literally going to happen, Edim Zomamim, it's never going to really happen, okay? It's there to teach you something. Because in what world is someone going to catch you at precisely the window of the sentence has been written down, but it hasn't yet been executed? You didn't have to travel from the courthouse to the execution chamber. It was right there, okay? What are the chances that in the world with no internet, okay, and no, and almost no other form of communication, that the people who could testify against these conspiring witnesses are going to be in the court in just the right place in just the right time? Okay, so one way to read Baribi is he's being crazy for the sake of being crazy. And he's being crazy for the sake of sticking it to the Sadducees. But an opposite way of reading Baribi, which I have to be honest, I'm not sure. I really feel like you could read him either way, is I'm going to narrow it even more. When I make it even more absurd, I'm going to make it so absurd that I'm going to save it. That I'm going to make it such a narrow window of possibility that it's never going to happen. Okay? That, if you're like very bothered by the ethics of it, that's how you're going to sleep tonight. You're going to say, ha, Baribi isn't saying something crazy to like make the laws of the Edim Zomamim absurd for the sake of the Sadducees. He's doing it in order to save the lives of the Edim Zomamim. Okay, he's doing it to say, I don't want to put an attempted murderer to death. So I'll make it that in order to testify against them, it has to be in this extremely narrow window. It's so implausible that someone is going to come in that window. Okay, I feel somewhat supported in these kinds of readings, really trying to figure out, how do I do this? Right? How do I preserve these principles that sometimes are competing, okay? And the principles are, I want to have a court that people respect. If I want to have a court that people respect, the court needs to punish, okay? You need to be afraid of the law. But also, the court's job is not to kill people, right? And the Torah isn't about killing people. The Torah is about preserving life. And so if I have a court that's too strict, then sure, everybody's going to be afraid of the law. But also, they're going to have innocent blood on their hands, right? Again, the same dynamic that we saw with Rabbi Huda ben Tabai. So let's read this Mishnah. I think it's going to make us feel better. Mi shenigmar dino. Okay, somebody has been convicted. Uvarach uvalifnei oto beitin. Okay, and then he runs away and then comes back to the same court. The first judgment is not set aside. Okay, you might have thought double jeopardy is not allowed to be tried for the same case. We just say, no, he still has his original sentence. He is still put to death. Okay, wherever two witnesses stand up and declare, we testify that so-and-so was tried and convicted at a certain court and that so-and-so were the witnesses, the accused is executed. Okay, so essentially we're saying it doesn't have to be the court that tried the case that does the execution. If the person who's guilty runs away and gets caught, you don't have to relitigate. Actually, we already tried this case and this was the outcome, and we can execute on the basis of that outcome. Okay. A Sanhedrin trial can happen both inside the land of Israel and outside of it. Great. The Sanhedrin is just a term that we use for a court of Jewish law that's 23 members or larger. Okay. And they are the only courts that can try a murder, right? You don't go to three guys on the street and have them try a murder. Okay, so a Sanhedrin works both inside the land of Israel and outside of the land of Israel. But a Sanhedrin that executes once in 7 years is called chavlani, is called a destroyer, is called murderous. And Rabbi Yezer ben Azariah says, no, even if they kill once in every 70 years, they're considered to be a murdering Beit Din. And Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfon say, had we been members of a Sanhedrin, no person would ever be put to death, right? Essentially, they're like, we'll figure out a way. Our prime motivation is to preserve human life. That's our goal. So if somebody comes and they are going to get the death penalty, we will do whatever legal gymnastics we need to do to get them off the hook because we don't want to be responsible for spilling this person's blood. Okay, that's essentially the orientation of the first three opinions here in the Mishnah. And then Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel comes back and he says, Av hein marbin shofchei damim b'Yisrael. Even they, meaning Rabbi Tarfon and Rabbi Akiva, are actually going to multiply murderers. Okay, essentially Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel is saying, right, in a way that I think reflects the tension that we've seen a few times already today, that if they are so concerned about putting someone to death and they just want to be lenient, okay, they're going to have spared the life of the person who's on trial. But what they'll have done writ large is say, if you want to kill someone, you're always going to get off the hook. And if the message that people get from the court is, they never actually want to kill anyone, they never actually want to carry out your sentence, then the court isn't going to be a deterrent. The death penalty is not going to be a deterrent, and people are just going to kill. Okay? So we have what seems like a very virtuous statement, right? In the first three clauses in that Mishnah, if you are a court that kills every 70 years at all, you're murderers. Who put life and death in your hands? Your job as a rabbi is to do the fancy footwork and to make sure that you never put anyone to death. Okay? And then Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says, you've taken out the teeth from the Beit Din. Now, nobody's going to have any fear of the law. And in your desire to spare this one person's life, because you don't want to have blood on your hands, which I will say personally identify with a lot, okay? But if you do that, what you are essentially going to do is give carte blanche to anybody who wants to murder. They're going to know that there's no consequences. Okay, and I think that both of these things are true at the same time, right? On the same time, we have to make sure that as a court, we are doing everything we possibly can to make sure that the people that we are punishing are truly guilty, right? And the rabbinic orientation is, in general, that it is much better to let a guilty person go free than it is to harm an innocent person, right? Especially if we're talking about something that's irreversible, okay, like taking someone's life. That is the general orientation of the rabbis, and we see that very clearly in this Mishnah. And on the other hand, right, we have Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel being the voice of, don't take this too far. Don't brag about what a softy you are. You're the court. And if we want people to listen to the court, sometimes you're going to need to be tough. People are going to need to be afraid of you. Okay, and I think that one of the animating principles behind Edim Zomamim, like the animating principles behind the rebellious kid and the idolatrous city and the false prophet, is we are very quick to dismiss these people. It was an attempted murder. He's just a guy standing on a soapbox. Like, let's just ignore him, right? It was a few people in the city. Why do we have to destroy the whole city, right? There is that tendency. And these laws are on the books to say, don't be so easygoing, okay? Sometimes there is going to be like a seed of rot that you are going to need to ubi arta, right? That you are going to need to pull out, okay? And it's violent and it seems disproportionate, but there's a concern of, if we don't take this seriously, then this rot is going to take hold and it's going to be too little too late when we try to fix it later. And I don't see the rabbis really having a resolution here, right? The best they can do is say, we're going to have these laws on the books, but we're never going to enforce them. Okay? And then it makes us feel better for a moment. Oh, thank God they're not enforcing these laws. Oh, thank God they're not killing these teens. Drosh v'kabel schar, we're just going to talk about it. Okay, but then there are other voices, which I think are really important voices, that say, no, you can't just reduce everything to talk. We're all just gentle parents, okay, and we never say no, it's going to end up doing more harm than good. It's going to be a short-term feel good, because you're not going to have executed this person or destroyed the city or burnt down this house, but you're going to pay for it later, because you weren't willing to make this example. Okay, so that's my sort of closing thoughts on the whole Edim Zomamim enterprise, because there's really two ways to look at Edim Zomamim. One is, it's just words, right? We don't even flog people if it's just a verbal sin. There's almost like no there there. They just sort of like went and they said something and it was untruthful. People lie all the time. But that's one narrative. And the other narrative is like, these people are murderers. Just because they didn't succeed doesn't mean they're not murderers, right? Just because they're murdering with their tongue doesn't mean it's not violent. And because it's so easy to get into court and lie, we need to be really tough. We need to have a no tolerance policy when we are trying to bring these people to justice. And there's no perfect balance. Right, and what the Gemara does is it just gives voice to both sides and hopes for the best. And that's all I can do for you also. I can only give you the voices of both sides and hope for the best, because we're not going to untie this knot. Right, all we can do is really look very closely and fully understand the different components. Gil, do you have a thought or a question?
Yeah, was there a punishment for conspiracy anywhere in the Talmud? Because this is a conspiracy, that's what you're really talking about. Is there any kind of punishment for that in this case?
So that's a subject of debate. Some people say you'll get lashes for the conspiracy, and some people will say, well, conspiracy is just words. And if you haven't actually been effective in any way, then we can't really punish you. Right. Okay? It's like the sound of the coins for the smell of alakas. Yes, Joelle, I see your hand.
First of all, I just want to say thank you so much. This has been really interesting. I haven't learned Talmud since high school, and this was actually enjoyable, unlike high school. High school, I think, is the last time I did it. This was actually enjoyable, unlike high school. But my question is that I didn't kind of get the comment about that Rabbi, I think Yehuda, you said made, that like, oh, if you say you're not going to use the death penalty, that makes you a softy. I feel like, and I don't know if this is like a comment or like a question, but like, I feel like that kind of ignores the reality that there are other punishments. Like, couldn't they throw someone in jail, or like they could give them lashes? Like, it's not, doesn't make you soft not to use the death penalty. It just makes that you know, not wanting the blood on your hands. So I'm wondering if there's any comments about that or if they discussed that.
Well, I have a response for you that is not going to make most people in this call happy. The Torah gives the death penalty for a whole bunch of things that we are like, that seems extreme. And I don't have a way out of it. And there is, like, the rabbis understand that they need to give the penalty that is prescribed. They can't just make up their own. So generally it's like an on-off switch. If you're not liable for the death penalty, you are off the hook. And the reason why the rabbis can do that is because they believe in God, right? They believe they have to do their part. The legal system has to function. They have to, you know, read the Torah accurately. They have to try their best to do God's will. But if an innocent person goes free or doesn't get punished, that's fine, right? God will make sure that they get theirs. Okay, so there's like a little bit of a theology in the back of their mind of like, if I kill someone who's innocent, there's no going back from that. If I let a guilty person go, God could have them get hit by a train. Problem solved, okay? And they really truly believe that. So I would say on the one hand, there is less flexibility. You know, there's no like sentencing guidelines where they can have more leniency. But they're also like very hesitant to apply the penalties that they have. They'll let somebody get off the hook or have it appear that they've gotten off the hook because they don't really feel like they're the ultimate arbiters of justice. They believe that God is the ultimate arbiter of justice, but they need to kind of keep the peace and keep things law-abiding on the human plane, which they feel responsible for. Okay, I think that's a good note for us to close. Thank you guys for sticking it out. And remember, you can lie however you want, but not in court because they're going to get you.